For a blind and print-impaired audience, your North Carolina Reading Service presents... The Indie Week, read by John Fetterson. And this week's issue, dated October the 13th, 2020... And our musical group with our theme tune today have asked to remain anonymous this week. I understand there are some law enforcement related issues, so they will just lurk in a back alley and hopefully return in about an hour. And as they chug off, I will chug along to our get busy with our issue of Indie Week. Well, this week is the Indie Week's endorsement issue beyond the endorsements for all of the local down and up ballot elections. There's a lead article and a cover called Vote Them Out. And it's written by Paul Blest and Lee Tauss with some other contributors. It's hard to see a silver lining these days. We knew dark times were ahead when President Donald Trump assumed office in 2017. We knew he would shovel conservative justices onto the Supreme Court, though few people predicted how thoroughly he and Mitch McConnell would remake the federal court system with young Federalist Society acolytes. We knew a Republican-dominated Congress would churn out tax cuts for the rich and work to undo the Affordable Care Act to benefit of private health care insurers. We knew he'd try to build a wall and demonize immigrants and expand on the immigration detention system built for him by Bush and Obama, but... on this issue and many others, Trump went further, separating children, babies even, from their parents and families as a form of punishment. Over time, the opposition to Trump has become numb to the perpetual outrage. With each new low, we lowered our expectations, but almost overnight, the COVID-19 pandemic toppled any sense of complacency or normalcy. Millions of workers either lost their jobs or were faced with the impossible choice of going broke or risking their health. Schools closed, businesses shuttered, and more than 215,000 people died because of the worst-run pandemic response in the entire world. The long-term effects of those stricken with this illness are still unknown. Then, over the summer, cities, suburbs, and small towns everywhere exploded in protests calling for an end to systemic racism as heavily armed right-wing extremists marched through the streets. But so far, we've seen little in the way of concrete action from most elected officials and outright hostility to anything resembling justice from the Trump administration on down to North Carolina's Republican-run state legislature. We're not going to sugarcoat this. The Democratic Party's not going to fix all those problems. Vice President Joe Biden and Senate candidate Cal Cunningham, the two Democratic names at the top of this year's ballot, think in terms of incrementalism rather than revolution. And sometimes the increments move backward rather than forward. Biden wasn't our top choice by any stretch of the imagination. Bernie Sanders would have fought for a Green New Deal and Medicare for all, while Elizabeth Warren would have wielded her authority to tackle monopolies and the worst excesses of capitalism. All those things are unlikely under a Biden term, but Biden's election would stop the bleeding in several key areas, from climate change and immigration to raising the minimum wage. Cunningham is even less perfect. In fact, recent revelations of an extramarital affair confirmed through cringeworthy text messages reveal a nauseating level of hubris and stupidity. It's hard to feel great about him, even if we know he'll reliably vote the party line. His nomination is yet another example of Democrats in Washington throwing their support behind the kind of candidate they believe North Carolinians want, rather than one who will tackle the problems that plague people here and everywhere: poverty, racial injustice, instability, and more. But the outcome of these two races atop the ballot of our swing state holds outsized sway. North Carolina could be the tipping state in terms of control of the White House and the Senate, where Republicans hold a slim majority. In other words, we're poised to once again play a pivotal role in the direction of our country. And while it's easy to feel like there are no great choices in this election, look further down the ballot, and you'll see that's not the case. In the gubernatorial race, Roy Cooper has been a steady hand during the pandemic, and his vetoes have helped stop the runaway General Assembly from enacting some of the worst impulses of the right. Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest is leaving his post to run for governor, and Labor Commissioner Sherry Berry is retiring. We have an opportunity to replace these Republicans with two highly qualified candidates, Yvonne Lewis Holley and Jessica Holmes, who would also make history as the first black woman ever to serve on North Carolina's Council of State. The General Assembly is also on the ballot, something few of us need to be reminded of. Since taking control of the legislature a decade ago, Republicans have written bigotry and inequality into state law. And because of gerrymandering, they've done so with little worry about electoral consequences. Democrats have promised to implement an independent redistricting commission to draw fair districts that actually reflect our seesaw political leanings, as well as to expand Medicaid and raise teacher pay. The state Supreme Court and Court of Appeals are also on the ballot, with Chief Justice Sherry Beasley, one of the most forceful voices for racial justice on any bench anywhere in the country, leading a group of Democratic judges to provide a crucial check on the right-wing politics of the last 10 years and try to reorient the justice system toward something that actually resembles justice. And finally, there were a slew of local races from county boards all the way down to soil and water district supervisor and an affordable housing bond in Raleigh, which may have the biggest impact on your everyday life. It's easy to feel disillusioned right now. There's been a coordinated, well-funded effort to make you feel disconnected from the political process for a long time. A lot of us can't help but feel worn down by it, especially since there's so much else going on in our lives. But at the very least, this election could serve as an outright rejection of so much of what has plagued us in this young century: inequality, corruption, authoritarianism, fascism, the vilification of those who fight it, and more. It could strengthen existing movements and create the conditions for organizing new ones. It could prove that we can and should demand more from our politics and political establishment. Joe Biden can't save us. Cal Cunningham can't save us. Only we can save us. And in this election, our best chance at survival is to get rid of Donald Trump and Tom Tillis forever. Vote them out. And vote democracy back in. And this issue of Indie Week is their endorsement issue. And most of the substantive articles consist of their 3- and 4-paragraph recommendations for every position that's available to us, at least in the Triangle area. And if I have room to read all of these, I kind of doubt that I will. What I'm going to do is maybe leave a sentence or two about their top picks, which we already know, and concentrate more on the down ballot folks. If I have time to go back, if I've missed something, I will try to get at it. And there are some arts columns as well. So let's go. The Senate and House, we already know probably what they feel about President and Vice President. We already heard that in the preamble. So Senate and House, Cal Cunningham. You don't have to like Cal Cunningham right now. The recklessness it takes to engage in a sophomore text affair midway through one of the most expensive and consequential races, combined with the scripted cowardice with which he skirted answering, are character flaws that undermine the trust. He carefully curated Southern gentilities, always rang a bit false. But the Indy swallowed our reservations for the sake of practicality during the primary, though in retrospect, his rival, Erica Smith, who has been busy endorsing Republicans, wouldn't have been a great choice either. It's hard to like him. It's hard to trust him. It's hard to choose him. Well, Tillis is a Trump loyalist. Even Cunningham can do better than that. Moving on to House District 2, Deborah Ross. That's one of the two districts that now lean Democratic in this latest iteration of our ever-changing electoral maps. So incumbent Republican Representative George Holding just decided to retire instead of running again. Deborah Ross, former director of the state ACLU, served in the legislature for 10 years and ran as the unsuccessful Democratic nominee for U.S. Senate in 2016, was a natural pick to run the new district. District 4, David Price. Heavyweight David Price faces a challenge from staunch Trump supporter Robert Thomas. Price, 80 years old, has been a member of the U.S. Congress for 31 years. Represents a district covering much of Raleigh, Cary, Chapel Hill, and Hillsboro. And going on to the Council of State, Lieutenant Governor Yvonne Lewis Holley, lifelong North Carolinian who served in the General Assembly for the last 8 years. She touts her bipartisan work to address food deserts in low-income communities. She thinks college students who were forced to abandon their dorm rooms after the COVID outbreak should be offered off-campus housing at reduced rates. She sponsored a bill to help residents affected by the pandemic pay their rent and mortgage and wants to extend moratoriums on evictions and foreclosures. Her opponent, Mark Robinson, a Greensboro native, small business owner who served in the Army Reserves. He did not submit a questionnaire to the Indy, but he's posted views on his Facebook page that raised 5 bell alarms. He opined that COVID-19 was a globalist conspiracy to destroy, quote, the progress of American exceptionalism that this president has promised and delivered. Roy Cooper is endorsed as governor. His challenger is Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest, an anti-science, anti-LGBTQ Trump fanboy. And again, I'm curtailing these point-by-point posts that IndyWeek puts in these endorsements, and you can easily go to their website and read everything in detail, gruesome detail. Attorney General, their recommendation, Josh Stein, a testament to his rising political star, a top recruit of the Democratic Senatorial Committee to run against Tom Tillis this year. He declined, and for good reason. Should he decide to run, he'd be the Democratic frontrunner for governor in 2024. As Attorney General, he's been a national leader among the state attorneys general fighting the Trump administration. His opponent, Republican Jim O'Neill, Forsyth County District Attorney. O'Neill, who ran for the nomination unsuccessfully in 2016, filed involuntary manslaughter charges against 5 detention officers and a nurse who allegedly killed 56-year-old black man John Neville. But part of O'Neill's pitch is that he would bring back the death penalty and, quote, stand strong against rioting in North Carolina, which is code for cracking down on peaceful protests. Secretary of State, recommendation, Elaine Marshall. A lot has changed since Elaine Marshall was first elected in 97. For starters, the Internet. For more than 2 decades, Marshall has effectively helmed the department, kept there perhaps by an unsuccessful run for U.S. Senate in 2010. Her loss is ostensibly our gain. Marshall has been a progressive advocate from her office, focusing on transparency and investing in the department's employees. Her challenger, Republican E.C. Sykes, who for some reason is fixated on stopping undocumented immigrants from becoming public notaries. For us, this is the wrong priority. Treasurer, Ronnie Chatterjee. On paper, there are a few more qualified candidates than Ronnie Chatterjee, who's career spans public and private sectors. He chaired Duke University's Fuqua School of Business and served as a senior economist on the White House Council of Economic Advisors, helping craft policies to lift America out of the Great Recession through tax cuts for small business and investment in local development. And Republican Dale Falwell isn't a terrible treasurer. In the last 4 years, he's managed the department effectively enough, but he's let his ideology leak into fiscal policy, namely with the exclusion of treatments for gender dysphoria from the state's health plan, which previously included it. State Auditor Beth Wood. More than a decade as state auditor, Democrat Beth Wood has become one of the chief reasons why anything in this state works at all. A North Carolina native leads an office that caught the Department of Agriculture allowing dairy farmers to label their milk grade A despite the presence of rodents and insects and generally unclean facilities. They found that Medicaid eligibility requirements were not consistent throughout the state and that in some counties, errors were made while processing as much as 25% of Medicaid application. She helped uncover gross overspending by the North Carolina Alcoholic Beverage Commission, revealing such disarray the findings called the idea of a state monopoly on liquor stores into question. Meanwhile, her Republican opponent, Anthony Street, has a record of personal conduct that seems unbefitting of the position he seeks. The guy's been accused of punching a man in the face, threatening to harm another man's family if he didn't give him money, and resisting arrest. and he was put on probation in 2018 for stalking a woman. Commissioner of Agriculture, Jenna Wadsworth. Republican Steve Troxler has helmed that agriculture department since 2004, when he narrowly clinched victory against Democrat Britt Cobb by a fraction of a percent. Since then, his margin of victory has steadily increased over Democratic challengers, as has his name recognition. He's known as the face of the North Carolina State Fair. To his credit, Troxler made the hard but necessary call to cancel the fair this year due to safety concerns. But his full repertoire doesn't serve a progressive agenda. For instance, he thinks it's cool that the sons of Confederate veterans pass out Confederate flags at the state fair, and has used the First Amendment to defend the group. We think someone like Jenna Wadsworth, a 31-year-old Democrat who has spent the last decade serving as Wake County's Water and Soil District Supervisor, can bring the fresh perspective needed to modernize the state fair. Step one, kick out the racists. Step two, lift up small businesses and develop apps to make the fair's ever-increasing culinary options easier to navigate. Commissioner of Insurance, Wayne Goodwin. Riding the red wave of 2016, Mike Causey became the first Republican insurance commissioner in the state's history after defeating 8-year incumbent Wayne Goodwin. Back then, Causey earned points by promising to overhaul the state's insurance system to attract big business, while Goodwin defended the current system and its low rates. Following his defeat, Goodwin went on to chair the North Carolina Democratic Party and wait for a rematch. This race is muddied by the FBI's investigation into convicted billionaire Greg Lindbergh. Causey wore a wire and helped nail Lindbergh on federal bribery charges after recording a conversation where Lindbergh and the state's former GOP chair, Robin Hayes, offered to bribe Causey with campaign funding in exchange for taking action to benefit Lindbergh's insurance companies. Meanwhile, Lindbergh heavily backed Goodwin's 2016 campaign, prompting the criticism that Goodwin was, quote, bought and paid for by Lindbergh. Goodwin's win could shift the balance of power by creating a Democrat majority council of state, which would bolster Governor Roy Cooper by giving him greater leverage on things like emergency orders. That's a deal we're willing to make. Superintendent of Public Instruction, Jen Mangrum. One of the low-key, most disappointing losses was June Atkinson, who had done a good job as North Carolina Superintendent of Public Instruction for 12 years. Mark Johnson, the Republican who beat her, gave up the office after just 4 years to run for Lieutenant Governor, a nomination he lost. Jen Mangrum, who ran a valiant effort against Phil Berger 2 years ago, is an assistant professor, former elementary school teacher who has a real potential to be one of the more progressive members of the Council of State. Her Republican opponent, Catherine Truitt, is a former high school English teacher and education advisor for Pat McCrory. For much of the year, she's been campaigning on giving local governments full control of whether or not schools should reopen, and she echoed Trump's administration talking points on reopening schools. No thanks. Commissioner of Labor, Jessica Holmes. Nearly everyone knows Sherry Berry not because of her policies, which were generally lax, but because she plastered her face in the state's elevator. As elevator queen, Berry enjoyed wide name recognition, which made her a formidable opponent, who most recently bested former Raleigh Mayor Charles Meeker by 10 points. Berry's decision not to run for re-election leaves the seat open for the first time in 2 decades. Jessica Holmes is the obvious choice to fill it. And should she win, she'll be the first African-American ever elected to statewide office. Let's see, the Republican pick to replace Berry is Josh Dobson, who currently serves in the State House of Representatives, a run-of-the-mill Republican who is recently accused of double-dipping, using the state as a piggy bank for collecting reimbursement for expenses such as housing and travel, while also funding those expenses through his campaign to the tune of nearly $90,000. Now let's talk to the state legislature from the Indy endorsement issue. And they open this. Have you ever felt embarrassed over the past decade about the state government? Angry? Frustrated? Well, you have every right to be. There's HB2, the motorcycle abortion bill, the methodical destruction of our unemployment system and the social safety net for poor and working class people in favor of tax giveaways to the wealthy, the repeal of the Racial Justice Act, the defunding of public education, the attacks on voting rights, the power grabs We could go on until November 3rd if you'd let us. Blame the North Carolina GOP for this. Since 2011, right-wing Republicans Phil Berger, Dan Forrest, Tom Tillis, and Tillis's successor Tim Moore have turned this state into a nightmare for vulnerable residents, which is saying a lot, because it's not like things were exactly great before. The reason they've been able to do this without fearing the repercussions too much, even in a swing state like this one, is gerrymandering. They started implementing it in 2011 and have repeatedly had to redraw our voting district because of various court orders and agreements. This year brought yet another new set of maps. This election is the chance to change that. Republicans still have a built-in advantage, but if there's enough of a wave, the Democrats could break the majority in one of two chambers of the state general assembly. The Democratic Party in North Carolina is nowhere near as progressive as we'd like. For example, the HB2 compromise from 2017 remains horrible. There's virtually no chance of even a unified government giving collective bargaining rights to public employees for the first time since the 1940s, but Democrats have two things going for them. They're backing an independent redistricting commission, and they are not North Carolina Republicans. We probably would have endorsed the vast majority of Democrats on this list either way, but the issue of gerrymandering rules above all else. Every other issue rests on the ability of voters to cast ballots in fair districts, especially considering what's at the top of the ticket this year. For that reason, we endorsed every Democrat running for the legislature in the Triangle. Wouldn't it be nice to never hear from Phil Berger again? And so, since we already know that there are Democrats, and I will just go down the list. District 14 of the State Senate, Dan Blue. District 15, Jay Chowdhury. District 16, Wiley Nickel. State Senate, District 17, Sam Searcy. District 18, Sarah Crawford. District 20, Natalie Murdoch. District 22, Mike Woodard. District 23, Valerie Fouché. And in the North Carolina House, in State House District 11, Allison Dahl. In District 29, Vernetta Alston. And State House District 30, Marcia Morey. And District 30, Zach Ford Hawkins. District 33, Rosa Gill. District 34, Greer Martin. State House District 35, Terrence Everett. District 36, Julie Van Hafen. District 37, Sydney Batch. District 38, Abe Jones. And Darren Jackson is the gets the endorsement in District 39. Joe John in District 40. And Gail Adcock in State House District 41. Cynthia Ball, District 49. Greg Meyer, District 50. District 54, Robert Reeves. And District 56, Verla Insko. Now, let's go ahead and look at if I can. I'm going to pause for a moment while I look over the next two pages. All right, in the state and federal columns now for the endorsements, many of these I've already read, but these are the Supreme Court seats that are open. Seat 1, Sherry Beasley is endorsed. Seat 2, Lucy Inman. Seat 4, Mark Davis. And the Court of Appeals, Seat 4, Tricia Shields. Seat 5, Christine Cubbage. Seat 6, Gray Stiers. Seat 7, Reuben Young. And in the Court of Appeals, Seat 13, Chris Brook. And I'm going moving down the columns. Let's see, we have now in Wake County specifically, we have District Judge 10F, Seat 2, Tim Gunther. Now, for the Wake County Commissioner's District, District 1, Sig Hutchinson, District 3, Maria Cervania, Shinika Thomas is endorsed in District 6, District 7, Vicki Adamson. Register of Deeds, Tammy Bruner. Now, the Board of Education, there are several seats, and the Board of Education is not specified in Wake County by political party. But the endorsements are Heather Scott in District 1, Monica Johnson-Hustler in 2, Chris Hagerty in District 7, Linda Mahaffey in District 8, and Bill Fletcher in District 9, and for Soil and Water Conservation Supervisor, Jean-Luc Duval. Now we're going ahead to, let's see, state and federal. We have that. This is for Durham County. And again, the state and federal officers are mostly the same, but now we have different chief justices and associate justices. And here we go. Supreme Court Justice, Seat 1, Sherry Beasley. Lucy Inman, Seat 2, Mark Davis, Seat 4. Court of Appeals, Tricia Shields. Well, those are all the same, as I've already read. I'm going to skip them. But for the State Senate, District 20, Natalie Murdoch. District 22, Mike Woodard. Vernetta Alston, District 29. Marcia Morey, District 30. Zach Ford Hawkins, 31. State House, District 54, Robert Reeves. And for the Durham County Commissioners, Nida Alam, Nimashina Burns, Heidi Carter, Brenda Howerton, Wendy Jacobs, and Anjali Boyd gets the nod for Soil and Water Conservation District Supervisor. And to Orange County. All of these are the same until we get to the State Senate. Valerie Fouché, no, we have her already. Greg Meyer, Valerie Insko, okay. And commissioners at large, we have, well, first we have a district court judge, Hathaway Pendergrasses, 15B, seat 3. And Orange County commissioners, we have Amy Fowler, Mark DeRosen, and Jean Hamilton. The way the issue of the Indy Week is organized now, they come to a little more detail about judicial elections. And I'll summarize. I've already read you their proposals for endorsements. With so much on the ballot, it's easy to forget that North Carolina has three state Supreme Court races and a slew of appellate contests that will determine whether liberals or conservatives control the state's top two courts. But, like the federal judiciary, the state judiciary plays a vital role that often goes unrecognized. Case in point. The Democrats have a 6-1 majority on the state Supreme Court following the election of Mike Morgan, Anita Earls, and Mark Davis last year. With that majority, liberals on the court have provided some semblance of a check on the General Assembly's power, like when it ruled this summer that the Republicans' repeal of the Racial Justice Act couldn't be applied retroactively. This year, three of those seats are up for grabs, which means the GOP could regain a majority, or the Democrats could even solidify theirs. So there are five seats on the North Carolina Court of Appeals where the Democrats have a narrow 8-7 majority and a slew of nonpartisan district court level races. Apart from civil litigation, this is one of the main ways that criminal justice reform can become a reality, by electing judges who understand that systemic bias and oppression are endemic in the system. So to make a long story short, get to know your judicial candidates. Here's a good place to start. And this list of Supreme Court Chief Justice, Sherry Beasley, Democrat. Her opponent, Paul Newby, is currently the only Republican justice on the state Supreme Court. In 2011, he questioned the relevance of race to the disproportionate incarceration of black people, and his view hasn't much changed. During this year, He was the lone dissent in the state Supreme Court's ruling that the repeal of Racial Justice Act couldn't be applied retroactively. Vote for Beasley. Associate Justice Lucy Inman. Paul Newby, the Supreme Court's only Republican justice, is vacating his seat to run against Chief Justice Sherry Beasley. Vying to replace him are two current appellate judges, Lucy Inman and the notorious Phil Berger Jr. Inman believes that racism within the justice system exists and supports reforms to make the legal system fairer and more accessible. Berger Jr., on the other hand, has been hit with allegations of campaign finance violation. As the district attorney of Rockingham County, he also installed a secret eavesdropping system at the court to listen to discussions between defense attorneys and judges, as the Triad City Beat reported earlier this year. It's an easy choice to go with Inman here. And in seat number four, Mark Davis gets the nod. He's a Roy Cooper appointee. He served ably on the court. Let's see. His opponent, the former state senator and UNC Chapel Hill business law professor Tamara Berenger, has done good work legislatively to modernize the state's foster care system, but her bid for the state's highest court, despite a lack of experience as a judge, makes us wary. Mark Davis more than deserves to stay. Tricia Shields gets the nod for appeals judge four. An impressive resume as a trial and appellate lawyer. And her opponent, the Republican April Wood, is a long-sitting district court judge who has said she views it as her duty to apply the law as it's written, even when it was written by a North Carolina legislature that loves passing insane laws. While we appreciate Justice Wood's service, we'd prefer someone who's comfortable overturning the status quo rather than simply reinforcing it. Appeals seat five, Laura Cubbage. The battle of the fifth on the fifth seat is between two current judges, Laura Cubbage and Fred Gore. Gore, a Republican, was a longtime prosecutor before becoming a district court judge. He said in an interview with the conservative North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation that the recent Supreme Court justice who best reflects his justice philosophy is Antonin Scalia. We'll go with Cubbage. Appeals Court Judge Seat 6, Gray Stiers. On his website, he proudly notes he's litigated cases in nearly every county in North Carolina, a state where he spent his entire legal career. Stiers is running against a Republican incumbent, Chris Dillon, who in 2018 wrote the opinion that upheld the North Carolina General Assembly's constitutional amendment instituting voter ID laws and tax caps. That case wound its way through the courts before it getting kicked back to the Court of Appeals, where Dillon wrote yet another opinion upholding the amendments. Judge Dillon has proven himself a fan of voter suppression, which means the guy's got to go. Reuben Young for seat number seven. He's a relative newcomer appointed by the governor in 2019. Let's see. Though Jeff Carpenter, the Republican challenger, is certainly a competent judge, the former state trooper is a bit too originalist for our tastes. And Chris Brook for seat number 13, the Court of Appeals, longtime former legal director of the state ACLU, argued some of the most high-profile legal cases in the state, including HB2 and voting rights. His opponent, Jefferson Griffin, a Wake County District Court judge and former prosecutor in the DA's office who describes himself as an originalist and has been endorsed by several law enforcement groups. The courts need fewer Scalia acolytes and more civil liberties advocates. Brooke has been a great one. He deserves election for a full term. And District Judge 10F, seat number 2, Timothy Gunther. As an attorney, he's worked cases in the fields of corporate law, tenant law, family law, and many others, but he takes special pride in his work as a criminal defense attorney. He's worked since 1994 as a court-appointed lawyer for defendants who can't afford their own counsel, and also volunteers with Project Together. While the Republican running for the judgeship, Beth Tanner, has done admirable work with the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission, her avowed conservative values give us pause, especially when we weighed them against Gunther's call for bail reforms. I'll run through North Carolina municipal elections now very briefly. And again, IndieWeek dot com or dot org, I've forgotten which one, would be a good source if you wanted to read their specific endorsements for all of these positions in detail. Board of Education, Wake County, District 2, Monica Johnson Hostler. District 7, Chris Hagerty. Lindsay Mahaffey from District 8, all in Wake County. District 9, Bill Fletcher and Jean-Luc Duval for Conservation and Soil and Water Conservation Supervisor. In Durham County, District Supervisor, Water and Soil Conservation, Anjali Boyd. And there are some uncontested races. They're not even races, are they? Durham Board of Commissioners, Nita Alam, Nimishina Burns, Heidi Carter, Brenda Howerton, Wendy Jacobs. I've already read those. And no one stepped up to challenge them. And there are several more like that. You'll see them on your ballot. And an article, small article on the housing bond in Raleigh. Vote yes. Raleigh residents have identified affordable housing as the top issue facing the city. An $80 million bond on the ballot this year seeks to offer modest help in the form of new developments in partnership with the private sector, amassing land for future affordable developments along transit corridors and providing financial assistance to homeowners. It's the last relic of Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin's Moonshot Bond package, which initially dreamed of funding the first phase of Dix Park's redevelopment. But the pandemic forced the council to reprioritize and ultimately downsize their ask of taxpayers. Raleigh has not passed a housing bond since 2011. In the last two decades, the city has issued just $50 million in affordable housing bonds. In that time, a national migration to mid-sized cities has hit Raleigh with dozens of new residents each day. The problem boils down to an issue of supply and demand. There are simply not enough affordable units in the city for those who need them. The result has been gentrification, pricing out many, and displacing longtime residents as developers erect gaudy, modern McMansions on once modest city plots. A housing bond won't magically solve the problem, but it will help people. It will create new affordable homes. It will purchase land in key areas to facilitate affordable development along transit lines. It will help long-time residents stay in place by providing them financial assistance. This, we think, is better than doing nothing at all. Unfortunately, a small political faction is hell-bent on stopping the bond. Their line is this: the bond is just enriching developers and doesn't build enough units for the very poor, so it's bad. Let's break that down. One, things don't get built for free. Things don't get built at a loss for the architects, engineers, and contractors. Businesses need to be profitable in order to participate in these projects. The city council can't lay the bricks themselves. Partnering with the private sector is the only option. Two, these developers will still build things without the city's help, and they won't be affordable. Not supporting the bond won't stop developers. Three, partnering with the private sector on low-income tax credit projects stretches the city's dollars as far as they can go and greatly reduces the cost per unit, meaning the city can build more while spending less. Four, doing nothing also doesn't solve the city's burgeoning affordability crisis. Grandstanding doesn't solve the problem either. One of the more visible figures behind this so-called anti-housing movement is former council member Steph Mendel, who lost her 2019 election in a landslide. She's joined by council member David Cox, the lone vote against the bond. This is politics at its worst. This same group, during its tenure controlling the council, did little to improve the lives of low-income residents in Raleigh. In fact, they opposed developments at every turn and were more fixated on protecting their neighborhood fiefdoms than addressing the city's growth. Development is not inherently evil. In fact, it's the only way out of the housing crisis. We're not paving paradise here. We're making space for our neighbors to live. A significant investment in affordable housing is long overdue. Durham passed a $95 million bond last year. Don't buy into the spin of a few sour grapes. We urge you to vote yes on the housing bond. All right. I apologize for all the long-winded endorsements, and there was certainly more information than I was able to read. I want to get to some of the arts-related columns, and this first one from the stage is online-only performance from Cat's Cradle, It Can't Happen Here. And its website is itcan'thappenhere.net. It's a virtual performance of Sinclair Lewis's prescient novel. Unemployment, social unrest, fear everywhere. And along comes a medicine man with the loudest voice in the whole world, and he shouts out that if we just put ourselves in his hands, our souls, bodies, our little trades, and the education of our children, then he'll do a miracle. Those words weren't written about our current political moment. They're from It Can't Happen Here, the Sinclair Lewis novel, in which a populist demagogue rises to the presidency with a promise of restoring lost greatness, but imposes an autocracy once he's in power. The bestseller was adapted for the stage and shown across the country in 1936, some 80 years before the election of Donald Trump. According to historian Tim Tyson and novelist Daniel Wallace, the thinly veiled Roman Aklef, based on the rise of 1930 politician Huey Long, has a reminder for audiences today. America has dealt with demagogues in the past and defeated them. This is why a group of professional regional actors will stream the play on October 18th, live from Cat's Cradle. By then, North Carolina's fourth day of early voting will have kicked into high gear. Wallace will introduce the performance. Tyson will host a discussion of the play at the end. Wallace says, It Can't Happen Here is eerie in its predictive qualities, including the rise in nativism and white supremacy. According to Tyson, as Lewis was writing the novel, the U.S. was in a national economic crisis freighted with racial and ethnic animosities, with malicious far-right militias being organized. Tyson says demagogues were dividing the nation, fanning existing fears and resentments while pounding their podiums about allegedly patriotic values. There's a lot of resonance between these two periods. Producer Leslie Frost became interested in adapting Lewis's text while driving through the South during Trump's 2016 campaign. As I listened to him, Frost recalls, I kept recognizing echoes of Huey Long, a strong-arm populist Louisiana governor and senator widely known as the Kingfish, whose 1935 assassination prevented a credible bid for the presidency the following year. Frost says, Trump's subjects, his tone, nicknames, bullying, focus on the fact that he was the one who would drain the swamp and bring government back to serve the people, and most of all his theatricality, are so reminiscent of Long's substance and style. Frost says, for her, Lewis's central character sounds like Huey Long, but has all the elements of our current president's character. The rise in Trumpist militias prompted Frost to contact director Joseph Megill to helm Sunday's production. Even before he called on the Proud Boys to stand down and stand by, there were frightening signs that armed right-wing responses to Black Lives Matter were inspired by our president's rhetoric. It seemed imperative to resist. And Wallace concludes, it doesn't take long to see the parallels between Lewis's imaginative world and the potential for a democracy to be perverted by a demagogue, including the possibility that some people wouldn't really mind that so much. It can happen here. It is happening here. Well, now we'll move over to Page. This is a column whose title I haven't seen much before, and it's written this week by Brian Howe, written in red clay. The Dean of North Carolina Rock Critics pens a loving landmark history of our state's popular music, and that critic is David Menconi. Robert Christgau was drunk and joking when he dubbed himself the Dean of American Rock Critics, but he meant it, and it stuck. You'd never hear David Menconi make so grand a claim. It would run contrary to his accessible, informed, but almost folksy writing, and unbefitting of someone who, in the prologue of his new book, locates the soul of North Carolina music and its people's humble pragmatism. But he has a better claim to the state title than anyone else. Manconi is a reliable, populist, rock-centric journalist and critic with an abiding interest in country, folk, and blues. His tenure chronicling local music for the News and Observer spanned 3 decades, beginning in the Camelot of early 90s indie rock and ending in a wave of buyouts just that last year. All of this richly funds Step It Up and Go from the UNC Press, his engaging new history of a century's worth of North Carolina's popular music. With chapters focusing on figures as larger than life as North Carolina will allow, from proto-bluegrass rocker Charlie Poole and Piedmont blues exemplar Blind Boy Fuller, to golden age hip-hop revivalist Little Brother, and the Empyrean Heights of American Idol, with stops in R&B, beach music, indie rock, and points outlying, Manconi's loving testament to our state's musical heritage is brisk and fun, but will also be cited as a reference for years to come. I recently called up the Dean of North Carolina Rock Critics to blab about why he gave a chapter to the forgotten 70s rock band Nantucket instead of Corrosion or of Conformity or Sylvan Esso, what it was really like when the national record industry swept through Chapel Hill for the legendary Big Record Stardom Convention in 1992, and assorted other music geekery. And this is a question-answer sort of column. Indy, how bad is COVID screwing up your book release plans? Pretty bad. I was going to curate and MC a stage out at the North Carolina State Fair. The waterfall stage was going to be the Step It Up and Go stage. It was going to be lots of fun, but not to be. Maybe next year, maybe someday if it does well enough for a paperback edition. So, it's all virtual. I'm doing one via Flyleaf with John Worster and Tom Maxwell. One with Scott Avett via Park Roads Books in Charlotte. You've been writing this book for decades, really. But over what span did it actually come together? I signed the contract on Groundhog Day in 2017, which seems kind of fitting. It took about a year longer than anticipated because the whole digital-first reinvention at the News and Observer just turned everybody's lives and jobs completely upside down. I thought I could hum through about a chapter a month and was actually doing it until the digital reinvention turned us all into real-time reporters. So, 3 years really focused on it, but another quarter century preceded that where I was sort of doing rough drafts of it without really realizing it. You were able to draw a lot on your prior reporting. How much new shoe leather did you burn? I did supplemental interviews for every chapter, and then a few chapters were kind of from the ground up, most notably the ones on beach music and Nantucket. I went back and forth on Nantucket. You kind of wonder, should Corrosion of Conformity get that chapter instead? What put Nantucket over the top was when I discovered that they started out as a beach band before becoming kind of the quintessential North Carolina 70s rock band. It's like, God, it's just so weird. I've got to make them the full-length chapter. This book has a good balance of famous things people want to know more about in those interesting niches. How did you decide who would get a chapter or section and who would get a sidebar? I definitely could have seen a Sylvan Esso chapter. Yeah, it's funny. If I'd been doing the book like a year later, Sylvan Esso probably would have been a chapter. Rhiannon Giddens would probably get her own chapter at this point. I'm sure there are decisions I made that won't make some people happy. I've already heard from some of them. But the great thing about North Carolina music is that you could write an equally compelling book about it with a completely different cast of characters. Because of your framing and the transient-filled nature of North Carolina, the book winds up taking a lot of musical history in throughout the country. How did you set out to frame it as being for a general audience that likes music versus a book about and for North Carolina? From the start, neither I or the editor, Mark Simpson Vos, over at UNC Press, were really interested in doing any sort of an A to Z encyclopedic treatment. We were more interested in a story you could tell. To that end, it's by necessity going to be connected to larger trends, both in the industry and the culture. It was a bit of a struggle to make it all mean something other than just a collection of chapters about acts from North Carolina. It was a very involved proposal process, just refining the chapter list, the most arduous one that I've gone through, which is as it should be because it's a lot more complicated book than any I've ever tried before. You did a great job of weaving in everything from the Great Migration to the alt-rock boom, all those national concerns. Were you here too, he asks, for that whole 90s alt-rock thing? I got into the music scene in Chapel Hill around 1999 or 2000. I felt like I'd just missed the party. That's when, Manconi says, that's when I was in grad school at the University of Texas in Austin. The Armadillo World Headquarters closed not long after I got there, and I kind of missed that whole progressive country thing, which I wound up writing a master's thesis about. Alt Country and Raleigh went on to be a significant beat for you. You wrote the Ryan Adams book, Lou's Ring, which had been problematized since he was canceled over abusive behavior, and you lightly step over Ryan Adams as best you can in the book. I had a really difficult, painful exchange with a superfan of his who's still loyal to him, and she was just furious that I gave him short shrift. It was just like, we're going to have to agree to disagree. And others will be furious you gave him any shrift at all. Yeah, exactly. I didn't feel like you could ignore him, but he wasn't going to get his own chapter. We were talking about the alt-rock rush. You got here to work for the NNO right in the center of that, right? January 91, the week the first Gulf War started. It was a funny, weird thing to live through. Not as funny and weird as it was for John Worster and Tom Maxwell, but plenty. I liked those bands, but it didn't occur to me that this was going to blow up into a thing. When people from record companies started calling, that was weird, and suddenly Spin, U.S. News and World Report, and everybody are coming around doing this stuff about the Chapel Hill sound. It was just kind of surreal. As is covered in the book, the fact that it was the last two bands anybody would have predicted that blew up, Squirrel Nut Zippers and Ben Folds 5, that was the strange cherry on top of the whole sundae. I was really happy you told that story about the guy cracking a beer can in the Spin writer's face to describe the Chapel Hill sound. I was never sure if that was true, but it's just so perfect. Tell me about the big record stardom convention where that took place. I was happy to be able to confirm and delighted that it actually happened. The festival was a lovely, unpretentious affair. People from out of town seemed to take it a lot more seriously than people in town did. Typical Chapel Hill. The press came. Grant Alden, who went on to co-found No Depression magazine, wrote about it for Alternative Press or somebody like that. Everybody played great. Superchunk just kind of smoked the field, of course. That was really the height of their power. I've seen very few bands that were better than them then, and they just went over like a house on fire. The strange thing about it, I guess, was that it felt like a crescendo, and people were wondering, all right, wow, is somebody going to wind up on Interscope Records and sell 2 million records? None of that really came to pass, but it was a hell of a party. There was kickball during the day, cookouts. It was super North Carolina, down home, and fun. My editor was just adamant about, why are they doing this? What do they hope to gain from it? I would ask them questions like that, and they'd look at me funny. You know, we're bringing in a bunch of people to see bands and probably get written about in Spin magazine. What's wrong with that? My editor so wanted there to be more than that, but there really wasn't. In terms of genre, the book is pretty well-rounded. If anything, it's a bit light on jazz, though we do get a lot of blues. Why is that? Mostly, it's my fault. It's not in my wheelhouse as much as this other stuff. I'm sure there will be people aghast that Monk and Coltrane don't get chapters, and there's a case to be made there, because those ain't nobody more important than those two. But I feel that's a different book. Maybe I'll even write that book someday. Did you learn anything about the music of North Carolina that you didn't already know? Beach music was something that I hadn't taken very seriously for a long time. To me, beach was these cover bands playing in parking lots wearing polyester. I was a snob, not very bright, so I just kind of dismissed it, but people kept telling me there was more to it. When I delved into it, there's this whole subtext that it came out of the Jim Crow era, part and parcel of segregation. That was fascinating. And there were some details that only a total dork like me would get a rise out, but I found it just hilarious that the same slimeball record guy was involved with both Charlie Poole and Arthur Smith. He was the guy who wouldn't let Charlie Poole do anything other than those old-timey records he was bored with doing. But he later signed Bob Willis, who was basically doing what Charlie Poole wanted to do. The stuff he was doing at the end of his life wasn't too far removed from Western swing. You can see it getting there if he'd gotten the chance. You can tell Charlie Poole really holds a place of reverence for you, even like mythological status. Well, I like the fact he keeps coming up. He's dotted here and there throughout other chapters, too. It's the great story of rock and roll fantasy. You don't want to romanticize it too much. Somebody drinking themselves to death before the age of 40, but he was a hard-living rock star. And the final question, what if linthead, the term that was used to describe mill workers like Poole, had stuck instead of Tar Heel, and they were the UNC lintheads? Should have given that a try, man, says David Menconi in that column. Only about half a minute to give us two reviews from LP in the area. Spencer Griffith gives 4 stars to Mipso and their eponymous album called Mipso, and it's the highest recommendation that he can give, whereas Grant Golden gives 3.5 stars to Owen Fitzgerald's Body, Child, Light, and Crime. And Amazon is providing a Prime Amazon horror for a focused production about 8 original thrillers released for free on Prime Video as double features. And these get moderate to below moderate reviews for this particular set of work. Well, listen to that. Well, our hour has passed. Our anonymous band, still wearing their cardboard boxes, have snuck back in to help close Indie Week with me, John Federson. If you want to rehear my breakneck reading of the voting endorsements again, and who wouldn't, it is available soon on the podcast tab of our website, ncreadingservice.org. So, get registered, please, and vote, please. So long for this week.